Welcome to Belt to Loda, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 1, Episode 2, and Episode 3. Amazon dropped all three of these at once. The names of those are Exodus, Churn, and Mother, in that order. I want to talk a little bit before we get started today and get into the episodes about the format of this podcast, because this first one is going to be a little bit weird. As they released three episodes, we realized, and we did this for the boys when they did the same thing, it's going to be a really long podcast if we try and break down a full recap for each of these episodes in a single podcast. So we tend to approach these things as like a thematic review of all three episodes. So that's what we're going to be doing today, but we will be going back to that full recap format in episode 4, because they'll start releasing them once a week. So, you know, if you hear the podcast and you're like, oh boy, I'm not sure I like that. Although, I, you know, if, last season was weird. They dropped them all at once. So this is probably going to be a change no matter where you come from with our Expanse coverage. But
right.
This is how we've decided to do it. And we think it works pretty well. So hopefully you guys will like it too. Aaron, it's been a year. We finally have new Expanse. Second season with Amazon. What'd you think of the start here?
It's all pretty impressive. Like I said, I thought it's a bit of a slow burn. Not that there's not action. There's some pretty cool space action. One of the things I've constantly kind of like encouraged them to do better on, let's say, is their zero G work. And I think that they had some really impressive zero G stuff. People that are like passively just kind of acting in zero G, I think, are doing a better job of it. And it pays off. It really helps sell the action. As far as it's great. There's a lot of great setup. There's a lot of exciting possibilities. It's unusual and weird to see the crew of the Rossi just kind of all over the place, split throughout the entire system. But it's also kind of gives each one an opportunity to shine. Mm-hmm. And boy, I tell you, the cliffhanger at the end of these three episodes is going to have a lot of people saying, God damn this release model, because you're going to want to do nothing but hit play on the next episode when you get to the end of episode 3, I predict. So what'd you think?
Reader? I really liked them. I did want to say, like, we're going to spoil all three of these episodes. If you haven't seen all three of them, probably don't listen to this podcast yet. Go watch the first three, because we're going to talk about that cliffhanger and the ending. So cut out right now if you haven't seen it. It's big.
Oh, wait. Another kind of show note is, just so people that don't know, you have read a lot of the books. I have read up until the last season. I've read up to book 4. So I'm kind of keeping up in the past tense, and you are several books ahead. So,
and I won't spoil anything either from those books. Like, I've read 5 and 6. I've read Gods of Risk, the novella. I'm going to try to keep all of that out of this podcast and keep from speculating too much based on information I have in the books. Now, I will say, if something in the show happens that has not happened in the book, you know, I'm obviously not going to be able to keep accidental spoilers out, right? But I'll also probably talk about things that are totally not in the books that are happening in the show and point those out. So I guess, like, there's some like negative inverse spoiler you could get from that, right? If a character is dead in the books or something and they're alive on screen, I might mention that, and that might be a bit of a spoiler if you're early on in the books.
I'll give you a perfect example of stuff that happens like that. For example, if you were to go and tell us all about Bull, who wasn't in season 3 like he is in book 3, you might be spoiled at the appearance and some of the backstory elements of Bull when he actually arrives, I assume, either to resume his role from the book or just out of nowhere to be the security chief for Tycho. But they're usually not. I mean, we went through this with Game of Thrones sometimes too, when we talk about things that didn't happen in the show that did happen in the book, and then two seasons later they take a small scene and it's not usually like big haymaker stuff. It's mostly background things.
Yeah. And I don't think Bull was a major character even in the books. Like, he had a big part to play, but also
he's a POV character, But he was essentially drummer, you know.
Right. They did a lot of that stuff with her. And I think they're still doing a lot of stuff with her that's going to be interesting from the books I've read, but we'll get there. I think this episode is, these three episodes actually are really good. Like you said, they're set up. They're definitely like moving all the pieces into place. But when that cliffhanger hits at the end of the third episode, I really felt like all of that was justified. Like you needed all of this stuff, especially like Avrasarala being so right. And, you know, having just completely called this thing exactly as it laid, and then nobody listening to her because of the actions in season four that she took, right? She's, and goddamn Nancy Gow, so fucking smug, so, just such a punchable face.
So much like Avrasarala, honestly.
I know.
Like, I love that the episode made that point because I was practically screaming it when she's feeling sorry for us. Like, this is you dealing with yourself, you know, in the past. And right. Obviously, it's frustrating.
Yeah. But so they did a lot of good stuff around Avrasarala. I would say the character that is closest to the books, the one that, like, they just basically lift his chapters right out is Amos. He is, like, right on track to where he was in the books. And so, some of these scenes are verbatim, like that train scene when they come in and he's like laying down there and then he gives this speech about, you know, how he can hold his breath for 2 minutes and do physical activity. That is verbatim from the book, word for word.
Okay. Is that from the churn or is this actually from book five? Because I figured a lot of this stuff came from the churn. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The churn is mostly flashback stuff, or all flashback stuff. Yeah. To his time as, you know, Timothy, back in Baltimore. And they're pulling a little bit of that.
I was expecting a little bit more of that. And I guess to the extent that he's going to remain on Earth, for, I don't know, however many episodes longer, maybe they can keep doing that. We did get a little bit like that flashback of him sitting on the dock with, his adopted mother, Lydia. Was kind of interesting.
It was hilarious because I kept seeing this kid and I'm like, God, this kid gets beat up so many times in a single day. How does this happen? And then, you know, I finally realized in that scene, oh, okay, this is Amos.
Right, right.
Remembering. But yeah, that scene you were talking about, that I think you were talking about, kind of blew my mind. It's the one where they're, you know, in zero G up on Tycho Station and they're just kind of disorienting you with the camera, right? It's rotating. Then it's flying in. It's this big oneer that kind of flies into the station. That whole scene is amazing. The people, you know, standing on the ceiling, the quote unquote ceiling, that there's this like no side down design to the entire station, or at least to certain parts of it where they're working. It's really cool. It's the exact stuff that I wanted to see that I'm not sure they've really been like overly concerned with in previous seasons.
Oh, yeah. And I thought that they do that a lot. Like anytime you see a space scene of like there's a shot of Philip, you know, boarding this research station and the outside of that ship. And they do that a lot with the cameras, like fucking with your perspective to really disorient you and sell you what it's like to be out in the void, you know. And I just love that stuff. And the fact that they really made the conscious decision to kind of unmoor the camera from any kind of direction. And I know they've done that in previous seasons, too. But like I felt like they really kicked it up a notch in this season. Some of those big sweeping establishing shots like you're talking about.
And well, the set design even is leaning into that, right? Like I said, the construction of the station itself, when you look at Ceres from the first couple of seasons, it does not look like it was built by Belters for Belters. It looks like it was built by Earthers for people to go work in the Earth fashion that they're used to.
Right. A set, you might say.
yeah. Right. This is a set, but it's also built by Belters for Belters. This Tycho Station set is awesome. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
All right, let's start talking about the episode in greater detail here. You want to start with Avasarala and her,
sure.
her stuff. She's kind of like got the, you know, the overarching plot stuff along with Holden and Johnson and stuff like that. But so what's Avasarala up to?
She's busted down to Luna. We knew this last episode season that the Nancy Gao wants to put her as far away as she can get without actually having her in the outer planets or Mars. So she's over on the moon and she is she's chairing a blue ribbon commission to investigate how you can do the thing that she thinks is dangerous faster.
Yeah.
And more of it. Just to kind of fuck with her and humiliate her. And she, for her part, is trying to do her best to do that job because she doesn't want to get fired from the government, but she's really looking out like she has for the entire series for Earth's, and maybe she shifted more to humanity at this point, but like for the greater good of Earth.
Yeah. And that's always been, you know, especially at the end of season four, that was a big question. Like, is she working for the greater good here, or is she working to secure her own power? Or essentially just to be right and win. And, you know, I think in her mind, they're one and the same. And I'm not sure that's not entirely true, because if you do have somebody in power who's making the wrong calls, that could be a problem for everyone.
I really like the framing device they use of her trying to get in the mind of her enemy, because it allows her to like ruminate and listen to Marco's speeches and, you know, see things in the background transpiring. And I also really like how the Expanse continues to do this. Nothing's perfect. Everything's messy. Like, Marco's plan is not going to go out without a hitch. One of the asteroids that they put on a trajectory slingshots too close to the sun. It goes back in time, saves humpback whales.
And then breaks up.
And then all of that excitement breaks up, and of course, it's only the outside it's sprayed with the stealth device. So now you've got this chunky string of pearls, you know, like the comet that Shoemaker Levy to hit Jupiter. It all is kind of strung out, and the scientists are excited because, you know, these inner planet asteroids are kind of rare, and they're just out there celebrating this big victory, and they get boarded by Belters who are trying to essentially clean up the mess of, oh, fuck, this stuff happened. And I just love that, like, countermeasure, you know, Earth's kind of skeptical. The belt is the OPA, the official organs of the OPA are actually working against Marco. There's a lot of that symmetry, and it feels, and what's the strength of this writing is that you don't have to rely on dumb villains or dumb heroes. It's all just, you have smart people like Avasaral and Holden and Naomi, and you got smart people like, you know, Marcos, say what you will about him, his monstrous ambitions, he's very smart, and Fred Johnson, and it's like they don't just make stupid decisions. They have limited information, they don't know what everything's going on, and there's tons of competing political, socioeconomic interests that kind of prevent them from just, you know, doing the right thing. And a lot of it is their own sins and hubris. Like, a lot of Avasarala's the difficulty is her own, you know, hubris and how she's treated people throughout her time in government, kind of coming back to bite her. And that just feels a hell of a lot more satisfying than, well, the guy just made a mistake, or, oh, she just didn't consider this, or, yeah, you know, Danny forgot that Euron had ships or whatever the hell that happens sometimes on other shows that the wheels fall off on. So I really like that.
Yeah, this is one of the things that Vince Gilligan talks about when he talks about Breaking Bad and what made that such a good show, especially in the Walt and Gus dynamic, where right. both of these guys are incredibly smart, and it would be a cop-out at the end to have one of them make a dumb mistake that then brings them down. And so instead, it's not that they make a stupid mistake, right? It's that they make an emotional call. They have an emotional vulnerability. And I feel like a lot of the times that's what they're trying to do here, right? There's a blind spot because of who they are, because of their history, all of that stuff. And it works to, you know, create smarter villains, smarter heroes. It works to help us sympathize with even the villains of this show. Like, there's a lot in Marco that you can go, yeah, you're right, buddy. You might be taking it too far, but you're right.
Yeah, it's like classic Magneto type of, you know, like he's not doing these vile, terrible things for no reason. He's got a lot of motivation. Right. It's just that there's a better path to take. It seems. I also really like, again, the uncertainty. Like Avasarala gets some critical intel that is a match. The ship that might have attacked. It's all circumstantial. Like the ship that might have attacked this research station. It's got a belt. It's a drive signature. It's a 53% match to Marcos, one of the ships that Marcos owns. And it's like, that's a coin flip. And is an admiral going to risk his career on a coin flip? And, you know, but then Avasarala thinks about it a little more. She's like, well, why were belters out there anywhere? Well, when's the last time we had a belter doing piracy in the inner planets?
It's
like,
this dangerous, is our...
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be like the Somali pirates operating off the coast of the Jersey Shore. Like, right. That in itself, like, even if it's just an isolated incident, that the fact that it happened would be fucking noteworthy to military and intelligence types. And her just kind of slowly trying to, like, look, man, you got to follow me on this. And him, you know, covering his ass. And he's got a point, you know, because you push this too far. Like, if Avasarala pushes it too far and gets kicked off of her committee, then she's just at home with Earth. On Earth with Arjun, and my God, if she's in the wrong place at the wrong time, say, I think the southwest coast of Africa is what gets hit at the end of this episode.
Yeah,
she's no more. You know, that's true. I mean, that was one of the big questions I had this year is like, is the asteroids going to actually hit Earth, or is it going to be one of those cliffhangers where they diffuse it, you know, 007?
Right.
There's 0 minutes and 0 seconds left, and 0.7 seconds left on the clock, and it looks like at least one's going to hit.
Dude, that's what I mean. Like I talked about in the preview episode, how this show and then the books continue to push the boundaries of what I think is possible on a scale perspective, and they're doing it here. Like they had an asteroid actually hit the Earth, which I did not think it's. It has the potential to be such a game changer that you almost think, well, we've got such a good thing going here. Why change it? But every time there's that opportunity to, you know, let off the gas and just idle for a little bit in something good, they slam on the gas and it keeps getting better and better. I'm constantly impressed by where they go with this show.
And there's also a lot of emotional stakes for Avasarala because her daughter comes to visit on the moon and you find out that her and Arjun are still estranged. And, you know, her daughter's like, look, mom, I don't, you know, is this between you and dad because your job is still important or the fact that you can't give up the fact that you don't even have your job anymore?
Yeah.
You know, you've been put out to pasture and you can see that actually kind of hits home, but Avasarala's got this hunch. She's got this itch in the back of her mind that this isn't over, that this isn't just her imagining things. And what do you do when the fate of an entire world, when billions perhaps could be in the balance?
And you think that fate is in the hands of someone who is not being nearly as cautious as they should be. Good question.
And the fact that, like, no one, even with all this evidence, I mean, that's the other thing is, like, no one, they made this point last year that no one can imagine the audacity of a plan like this, mm-hmm. that you would, no one thinks that Mars stealth technology, the crown jewels of the Martian military thing can be stolen, and no one would think that a belter could be sophisticated enough to use it and put it on an asteroid, and they're more, and it also just the foolishness of old conflicts, like Earth can't even on a hunch retask its watchtowers systems. The only thing that can detect a stealth missile, because they got to stay laser locked on Mars, because what if Mars takes this opportunity? And she's like, Mars doesn't give a f-. And it's really interesting when you actually go to Mars and you see that Mars really doesn't give a fuck.
Oh, no, they're like, shutting down Mars.
And did you notice, like, something that I know I love about the Expanse is they subtly changed their intro a lot like Game of Thrones. And before, Mars was all, when you got to Mars, you saw these, like, the cities going up and the lights turning on. Now, when you see the soldiers standing in the valley, the lights are all winking off.
Huh.
Like,
nice.
Mars is closing up shop. It's, and now there's actually rockets taking off in the intro to show that, and they tell that story. It's nothing that they sit down and dwell on, you know, that Mars is a ghost town. It's something that Bobby had to grapple with, and to see Alex grapple with it now. And they don't tell you. It's just him standing around in this Martian city and seeing, oh my God, this is a ghost town now.
Yeah. He's like on the DS9 promenade. Nobody's walking through. Garrick shut down shop with a for sale sign on his store.
Yeah. Quark's all bottles of synthol must go.
Yep. Yep. Selling them 2 for 1. That's not very Quark like.
Yeah.
No, I love that shot when he's just like, got all these shops shutting down.
And everything just happens just too late. Like, that's the other thing that feels so realistic. She gets this vital piece of intelligence, I think, from Drummer through Fred to Avasarala, back channeled about the revealing this plan with the asteroid.
Yeah.
And she gets it as the asteroid is tearing through the atmosphere of Earth.
It's the thing that proves her theory right, and it just comes a little bit too late.
But it's too late. But we know there's, 7 to 9 other asteroids?
Rock number 9 is the one they show breaking up? Is that right?
I wasn't sure. I couldn't keep track of which numbers. I couldn't read the screens. But yeah, I think there's either 8 or 10. The open question now is there going to be enough time to avert further disaster? Or is this like, I could also see this being every episode, like one or two rocks hitting Earth, and what the hell is Earth going to do about it? You know?
Yeah. And even if there's time to, catch rocks before they hit, can they see them? Because this one was only caught because the stealth, shielding was the stealth paint was only on one side. It was on the inside of the rock. So yeah.
I've also wondered, like, The watchtower system, like, is that a 100% kill? Like, if it can find something, can it find a rock? Can it find, it's designed to find stealth missiles, but still have, like, presumably drive plumes and are coming on fixed trajectories and probably go, I don't know, maybe going slower than asteroids.
I would think so, yeah. Like, you can get an asteroid going pretty fast.
Yeah, yeah, just orbital velocities around the sun being what they are.
Yeah.
The one scientist that they brought in for the second opinion said something about how fast they were going, but I didn't catch it. Speaking of that guy, one of the big cliffhangers is, what's the punchline of that joke?
I know, Delgado's, man. I feel like the punchline of that joke is in that scene, but I didn't go back and analyze it, because he's telling a joke about a bartender who's serving to a Martian and a belter, right?
And a belter.
Then the guy walks in, and I'm like, okay, that's part of the joke, but what does it mean?
Right, and he wants bourbon because a lot of times those jokes are like references to other jokes, like, a Russian, a European, an American walk in a bar. And
right.
And I wonder, like, my guess is something about is going to be something about Earther arrogance. Like, the Earther guy just drinks whatever because he doesn't even think about the other two factions. But I don't know, because I tried to search for that form of joke on Google and I couldn't find nothing. So I need to know the punchline. If you know the punchline to this, I imagine some old intelligence or military joke, send it in to expanse@baldmove.com, because I would like to know it. It bugged me. It bugged me that never came back up.
We might be done talking about Avasarala's stuff for now. Maybe we should move over to Drummer, because she's very closely tied, like you said, with that message to Avasarala's plot. So she's out in space, basically on a quest to avenge Ashford, right? She's out there hunting pirates and looking for Marco so she can kill him. And she eventually finds Ashford's old ship, and it's been totally stripped. And, that leads her to the backup data, which has the message, and she sends to Fred, and Fred sends to Avasarala, all that.
I think, I really like, because it's I've always thought Drummer's a badass, but she's always been someone else's second banana. You know, her career has always been about being under other people that are actually calling the shots. And one of the reasons she says in the show is that she turned down Ashford's because he wanted to hunt down, and I don't think she did. She wanted to kind of do her own thing, make her own name, and kind of like dip out of politics for a while. And there's this like, I don't know. She's not exactly Robin Hood. What she's doing is she's waiting for Belter pirates to jump colony ships, and then she comes in for the rescue, charges 10% of their take, and makes sure no one dies.
Yeah.
Because she's got this like the Wire philosophy is like, you know, the petty crime's petty crime. Bodies is what draws attention, and inner attention looks like Belter bodies. So she's kind of doing this. It's not altruistic. It's a service. Like I'm sparing people's lives. And I'm taking a cut of it.
It's a protection racket. It's not quite a racket because the attack was going to happen anyway. But you know,
it's almost like it's like Batman, only he charges you money after he saves you from the mugger.
Right.
Or he takes a cut of the mugger's money and make sure the mugger doesn't hurt you. Like it's, and I did like where the colonist ship, questions her about like, you know, how can you sleep? You took everything from my side. And she's like, I did not take everything. Cause you know, you can lose a hell of a lot more in the void out here.
Oh yeah.
But she's just such a badass. She's got two ships. Did she hit that other pirate ship with like an EMP bomb? I'm not really familiar.
I'm not sure.
I fucking love all the military stuff. Like, I don't understand what all is happening, but like this, it happens so fast. Like, another ship comes in, launches two torpedoes. One of them gets taken out by this flak gun, but the other one hits and I guess disables it. It's just, you know, Drummer looks like a badass. Her makeup is full on death mask. Like, she's got these just jet black eye sockets and she's super pale. She looks like a skull commanding this. It's just really, really badass. The fact that she's found kind of like a family, I thought that them exploring that, the loyalty she has to her crew and vice versa was really good too.
Yeah, that's the part that's making me think that they might be setting her up to become Michio Pa from one of the later books, and I won't spoil anything, but that like ship family sort of dynamic is you know, more sexual than the one even that's going on the Rossi.
That was another cool, like, how kind of like by 21st century, non-conventional, you've got like thruples and couples, and they're all kinds of mixes of genders and sexualities and races. And it's just a big, 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 big puppy piles of belters and beds and stuff.
I learned the term from my wife while we were watching this episode. Polycule. Have you heard that term?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Polycule. Yeah, sure. Yeah,
that's how she described this.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
They also they by finding Ashford's ship, they now have a modest armada of three ships. Clauses used to be the most powerful like belter skiff in the belt, and probably not now that Fred's pumping them out and providing the OPA with a real navy. But for independent crew, you know, having these three ships is going to offer them a lot of options in their piracy,
for sure. Serge is her pilot. He was in one of the books. I think he was in book three and he died during one of the mutinies on the Behemoth. Mm. So they brought that character in, to this season. I really don't know why, maybe because it's a cool name.
Do you know the name of Drummer's lover? Is that her XO as well too?
I don't. You know what? That's actually the woman. Isn't that the woman who played Susan Jacobs in Mr. Robot? Susan Jacobs is the woman who died
somewhere. Yeah. I knew I'd seen her somewhere.
Like, it's not Okoye. I know that's a scientist. It's something like that. Oksana, maybe, or
I didn't catch her name. You know what? And also, I don't even know what positions mean in a pirate ship. You know, you have a captain, you probably have a second command, but it kind of probably gets pretty loose and cross-trainy down from there. Because, you know, when everyone, you know, that's the other cool thing is like how they all pull together, you know, like they're just, it felt like kind of like Firefly, that they're just looking to fly one more day. You know, they're just trying to get enough money to keep out here and keep doing the thing.
I mean, frankly, it's a lot like the Rossi dynamic, right?
Yeah, and how her crew like will work tirelessly. Like they really sell like what a big job it was to salvage Ashford's ship.
Yeah.
And even then, when she announces that they're going to go after Marco, everyone's nervous and afraid, but they're going to do it. And it's not until her lover slash XO comes and says, like, you know, you do have a family, and because of that, maybe you don't want to just throw us into a meat grinder for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Although I gotta say, sorry.
I was going to say about that. She opens that bottle of McGlinton's or whatever, which I think is not a real whiskey. I looked it up. And then she puts the cap right back on it without drinking it. Is that her saying, okay, she's not quite done with the memory of Ashford? Or is that her like putting him on a shelf for to deal with later after they have some kind of stability?
My guess is that that is being put away from for a special occasion. And I'm guessing the special occasion is Marco's head being put on the prow of her ship.
But that's also the moment where she has come off this avenging mission, right? Like I get the impression that she is simultaneously like holding this candle for, you know, some kind of revenge, but also they're off that mission now.
They're off the mission. I think it'd be very easy for them to get back on the mission, especially with the
good enough lead
that's going to be the next couple episodes. And also, I think that from her mental state in this episode, she's putting it aside because, like, if Fred gets him, if Avasarala gets him, if Earth or Mars, whoever, like, she's going to save that for when Marcos is strung up and wherever it is by whoever's hand, and she's going to drink a toast to Ashford at that, you know, because, like... Okay. I felt like they'd done a pretty good job of showing that they had a real mentor mentee, you know, almost father daughter type of relationship. That, you know, he taught her how to be a pirate. Fred taught her how to be a leader, and now she's putting all those skills to use on her own. And you know, both of those people are important to her. So. But yeah, I think she's got it. She's not going to directly go into revenge, but it's probably going to be pretty easy to redirect her back.
Sure. The other thing I noticed in drummer scenes is there are a lot of DeWalt logos, like on screens in her ship and stuff. And I'm wondering,
one of her ships is called DeWalt.
Is it called DeWalt? Okay, that's why it was up there. I was wondering if that was like product placement for the construction, the tool company, because I can see that, right? Like DeWalt is the you know, the whatever Mikowski Mao, whatever it is.
Sure, because that corporation got broke up, so there's probably it's just, she's piloting the DeWalt and the Ryobi into battle is the two names of their ships.
Ashford's ship is the Makita. It's
The DeWalt and the Motang is is the names of the two ships. So unfortunately not Ryobi. They got bought out by the fucking Black and Decker conglomerate in 2237. So the Ryobi's syndicate no more.
The other plot line here that's sort of connected to these other two, the Marco stuff maybe, is Holden and Monica and what they're up to during this. And I guess Fred Johnson as well. We kind of group them together.
Before we move on, do you agree with my chain of custody? There's no way Drummer sent this right to Avasarala. She sent it to Fred, I'm guessing.
If she's the only way that would not be true is if she's like spoofing Fred's number or something, because when Avasarala gets the call, it comes from Fred Johnson.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. Because the other possibility I considered is Sake. I forget the name of the Belter mechanic. But she mentioned that Fred's organization leaks like a sieve.
Yeah.
Or no, Monica does. Monica does.
Uh-huh.
So I thought that maybe Avasarala has her, like, you know, she got that through some clandestine mint. But it seems like, okay. So yeah, it goes Drummer to Fred to Avasarala.
I think so.
Why does Fred share this intel with her?
I mean, I assume it's because he doesn't want to see Earth destroyed either. But I don't know. Fred's tough to read sometimes, you know.
He is an Earther. Plus, I think he thinks that's what a good... He wants the Belt and Earth and Mars to be... He doesn't want to be their superior. Like Marcos does. Marcos wants the Belter way to be the way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Fred wants an equal seat at the table and to be a friend, and friends look out for each other.
He wants there still to be a table, whereas Marco doesn't even want the table to exist.
Yeah, he wants to flip over the table and have the Terrans, all the inners underneath the Belter heel.
Yeah, and it's just different philosophies on how to go about securing Belter power. All right, let's move over to Holden and Monica and Fred, because they're all tied in together. And Monica is kind of the impetus for all this. Maybe we should talk about Holden, because he finds himself in an interesting place at the beginning of this season, which is Amos has gone off to do his thing on Earth. Alex has gone off to do his thing on Mars. Naomi is off to Palace Station on a mission to find Philip. He's left all alone. I don't know how much you understood, because in the book they go into this a lot, how Holden just feels completely just at no ease whatsoever when he's got this downtime and he's away from his crew. He just doesn't know what to do with himself. And they do that pretty effectively, I thought, in the show, where, you know, they show him flipping through the messages and being sort of bummed that nobody's contacted him and realizing, like, oh, my crew is gone. My ship is in dry dock here. I can't do much. And then he goes down and he's trying to, like, you know, not necessarily spearhead the repairs of the Rossi, but like get his fingers into that pie.
Yeah. Make sure it's being done right.
He's just restless. And that I thought came through pretty well, but I've read the book, so I wasn't sure if you like picked up on all that stuff.
Yeah, I got it. His kind of loan, the fact that he's kind of upset or not upset. Well, no, upset that Naomi's kind of freezing him out on the mission that she's going on, and that leaves him kind of and he's worried about it. In fact, he's kind of looking at her ship leave the station. I thought they told the story. They also, I thought, did a really good job. If you hadn't, you know, rewatched the series like we had leading up to this, kind of reacquainting everyone with the stakes through Holden's story. Like, there's this big screen TV in the background showing like what a boom time it is for the Belters, and particularly because they hold the ring gate through Medina Station. And there's, you know, new worlds opening up all the time. And there's been no more protomolecule type of mischief. And they did a lot of really good stuff like that. And the war college speech to kind of give, like, if you didn't understand, you'd forgotten the critical importance of the station and how it worked. They did a really good job of catching people up, I thought, without stopping and just giving exposition.
Yeah, for sure. Monica gets this lead on something. You know, she's investigating the protomolecule sample that's still out there. And ends up getting herself into a situation where she's captured and put into a storage container and stored at Tycho Station amongst the other shipping containers.
That's so effective, because that big establishing swooping shot showed us like what a fucking dockyard that is. Like, thousands of these containers stacked deep and all over the place. So it's like a really frightening situation to be in.
And it makes me question, like, why would someone do this? Because the thing that I expected is, oh, they stuck her in here and, you know, they expect her to die. But they put a CO2 scrubber, an O2, mm-hmm. an air oxygen cleaner or whatever.
Inside the thing.
Why do that if you want someone dead? They clearly don't want her dead.
That was my question, too.
A distraction, right? It seems like a distraction to me.
That's the thing I couldn't figure out, is like, what critical importance does this journalist, who has been on the forefront of a lot of stuff, and I don't know whether like Marcos wants to capture her to use her as a mouthpiece, you know, to kind of like get his story out, or what? But that was one of the questions I had, because like, it's, you know, the Fred locks everything down, so she's dead or alive, she's on the station. But like, yeah, why not just kill her or silence her?
Yeah.
I don't have a good answer for that.
I don't either. Hopefully we get one later.
I did like the one of the things in passing is like, we get to see all four of the member crew of the Rossi kind of like dealing with their fame. You know, Holden gets recognized at the bar and everyone kind of salutes him. And I like how he's kind of like puts on the good face and he turns back. He's like, oh, there's a... Amos doesn't really get to use his fame because he's out of context.
Yeah.
Naomi almost gets killed for it. And Alex is just, I don't know, kind of in enjoying it, I suppose. But I liked everyone, you know, the fact that the Rocinante is, I don't even know how the hell, there's no terrestrial way to talk about this level of fame. Like, imagine like a Caribbean pirate but or more privateer that would be world famous because the internet existed in the 16th century. Like,
yeah,
what are these people are like Che Guevara and like George Washington and Ernest Hemingway, and like they're all this wrapped up like all in one, and they've been at the center of like all this crazy action. So
their face has been all over the news. It's like a movie star that also has a system saving mythos around them, right?
Yeah, and I like that, especially Holden, who's kind of been the face of all this. Like, he just it would be unrealistic if the show didn't deal with the fact that these people are famous. And I like that they're doing it in their way. And Amos maybe, because he's tried to stay off camera as much as possible.
Is it Belter paparazzi that kind of congregates around Naomi when she gets off at Palace Station, or is that
I thought that was everyone desperate to get off. Like, they want to.
Okay, it's a fine
passage. Are you a colony ship? Because they were all screaming, like, I'm qualified to do this. I'm an excellent engineer. I've got to. Like, they're just wanting to get the hell off of that because, you know, everything. Like, you know, if you're not on a gravity well, living large, there's 1,000 planets out there waiting for you to get that slice of the pie. So, like, if you're poor and you got nothing, it's just, like, trying to get anyone. Like, yeah, do you need a mechanic? Do you need this? Do you need that? Because I was confused that the first time I watched it, and, you know, having screeners, you don't get subtitles. But that's what I thought. It's like they're just desperate to get off any ship, any transport, any freighter that lands probably gets this treatment.
Yeah, it works either way. I liked it. So, yeah, they find her. They find this message. There's a lot of little stuff that we're kind of glossing over. Like,
let's talk about their conversation between Fred and Holden. There's a real nice long conversation where they talk politics, essentially. Mm-hmm. Fred's got the protomolecule, and I think he's right. If the Belt didn't have the protomolecule and our Earth and Mars both knew about it, they'd probably already bullied him out of the ring gate. But since this faction does have like a legit super weapon, you know, they have this fragile balance. And what Fred's point is, like, once the OPA can patrol itself and have enough warships to kind of protect itself, then we won't need any more, and I'll be the first one to get rid of it. I don't know.
That's an open question.
Just when I thought the protomolecule was a dead issue on this show and it's just going to be ring gates, and there's no fucking way. There's no fucking way. What's that guy's name? Cortazar?
The scientist.
The crazy-ass scientist getting abducted. Like, there's no way that this isn't going to become... And it makes it really ominous, that first episode newscast, where, like, oh, the machines are dead. Mm-hmm. And Alex saying, like, well, now that the last of that proto shit is gone, that'll never happen again. Oh, God.
They do so much with, like, setting up the rug and laying it out so nicely just so they can pull it out from under you eventually. Like, at the end of this three... episode arc, there's an asteroid that hits Earth and causes huge amounts of devastation, and I like how early on they're just like, Holden's telling Fred, like, the world will go on without you, nothing's gonna change, don't worry, and then boom, Earth is getting hit with massive rocks. They set up a lot of this stuff really well just to yank it out from under you.
And a lot of it's a lot like Avasarala's speech. Like, why are you doing this still? This is dumb. You've got a ship. You got people that love you. I really like Holden's affect when he's trying to explain the drummer, or not drummer, Fred, about getting his brain reprogrammed. And oh my God, the lines that Fred has. He says, you know, son, claiming brain damage isn't the way to convince me on this. And then later on, when they're looking for Monica and the phone bit, and he picks up, he's like, what did you do? He says, I just pushed a button. And he goes, Jesus Christ, that really is how you go through life in it. Yeah. Is that from the book? Because
I don't think so. That sentiment is in the book, not that line, but that line is so good. Maybe the best line.
That line had me rolling. Yeah. And, you know, Chad did such a great job. You know, I've missed Fred for so much of the last few seasons. He's just been like in, and he's so great. But that's really how you go through life in it. So funny. So funny.
Yeah, it you know, so you talked about how you've missed Fred. I miss Anderson Dawes. And Dawes is mentioned in this episode. he says the Dawes confirmed the video, right? This is actual footage of Cortazar being taken.
Because Dawes had Cortazar, Fred has the protomolecule. I think that's the
split. And you might not
split.
Remember that because it's been so long. What was that, season?
It has.
Two? The end of season mm-hmm. two, Dawes takes Cortazar and flies off of Tycho. So, yeah, I'm thinking at this point that we're not going to get Jared Harris back because they just keep mentioning him. Jared Harris has gone on to become a very big star in some high profile things like Chernobyl. I don't know if this show is going to bring him back. And I'm a little sad.
I wish they would because I felt like that he was always going to be like him and Fred teaming up was going to be the natural counter to Marco. You know, like they both had like a bigger, well, I don't know, like Marco's got a big plan for the belt, but they had a more conventional kind of like, hey, equal status among other nations kind of thing. And Marco doesn't.
A more moderate approach. Yeah.
Yeah. What's funny is because until Marco showed up, I would say that Dawes was the radical and Johnson the conservative. But now Dawes is a centrist. Holy shit, I guess.
Dawes is a radical from a certain point of view. But not Marcos.
And they did a really good job of showing how Fred Johnson's kind of losing. You know, he had that great scene where he's yelling at Bull and about like, you know, don't want to lose control of the state. And he's like, I've already lost control. I want to get it back. Mm-hmm. And also, I think I can't remember in book three if this is a big deal with Bull. But the fact that he's, you know, a Terran Marine, you know, ate as much mud and probably spilt as much blood as Fred Johnson, the, you know, butcher of Anderson Station. It's going to be a real problem, his hatred of Belters, I think, and being a security force over them. Like, that's always a bad idea. That's essentially the same plot of Murtry last year. He's not as big an asshole as Murtry, and he's got a shorter leash to a saner person, but...
And what was going on Sirius Station? Like, this is the Belter plight, right? The Belters are being used for the purposes of Earth and... Well, largely Earth, but the Inners in general. And it's always been that way. And that's what they're fighting against. That's what Marco's fighting against. That's what, you know, Dawes is fighting against. And it, you know, it's if things are left to their own devices and if, you know, something isn't done about it definitively, then Earth will continue to do what they've always done to the Belt.
Yeah. And it sucks because, like, from a Belter's perspective, if they do what they're told and do their jobs, they're neglected, abused, ignored, taken advantage of. And if they try to fight back, they're terrorists and they're brutalized.
Right.
So, and 99% of them just want to live and raise families, and they're caught in between. It's a really miserable, really, really miserable situation with very easy real-world analogs to plug in there.
So let's plug in another character, yeah? These other ones are kind of off on their own missions. I think
that we ought to, that they actually did find Monica at the last minute.
Yeah, and they saved her life.
The other thing is there is the final note on this Holden plot is the Marco's ship or they do a whole bunch of there's a whole bunch of steps to them trying to track down who owns this container, but there is a ship inbound, the Zameya, which is Russian for snake, that's coming to the station to pick up that container. And their plan is to let it in, close the doors, and then hopefully capture and interrogate them and have that lead to Marco.
Yeah, we'll see.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
All right, somebody who is sort of connected in a way, is Alex and Bobby. They're kind of on the same mission over the course of this. Like, Alex goes to Mars and he wants to reconnect with his wife and his kid, and that goes spectacularly wrong. They want absolutely nothing to do with him. His kid a little more so, but it still won't return like the I love you that Alex gives him.
It's awkward. Yeah,
it's super awkward. And you know, while he's on Mars, he connects with Bobby, who is on this mission to figure out where the Martian weapons that are being supplied to Belters are coming from. And she's doing that with the backing of Ava Sarala. As we saw in the last episode of last season, she reconnected with Ava Sarala, and now they're on that mission together.
Has some serious bankroll. Like, she's got some serious money. It seems like she's used some of that to help her crime boss's wife and child from last season get off of Mars, and they're on the way to a colony ship. So she's doing her part to help people.
I like that. That's a sort of two birds, one stone thing, right? Because it gets him out of the equation, which he's, you know, one of the guys spearheading a lot of this buying of Martian weapons and the transfer of weaponry.
It's funny because when she's out there on Mars, the Martian plane's doing a complicated deal for a Goliath weapons suit, or power suit. I thought, like, oh man, this is like Carrie Matheson from like a Homeland type, early goings of Homeland, like, you know, trying to investigate terror and do all this financial stuff. And then she gets back to her Bobby cave and she throws up like one of those hollow, like, you know, classic red yarn boards with all these connections. And,
yeah.
You see this all the time. I was like, oh man, we're getting some Martian Homeland.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. I like Bobby working as this kind of like secret agent undercover. It's really, really, really cool.
You know, you said the Bobby cave. What I cannot wait for is when she has to bust out all this gear, like her in a Goliath suit with a bunch of stealth wrist rockets. And I don't know what she's going to have, but it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, man. When she goes, when Alex is like, all right, we'll get ready. And she's like, hold on a second, I go get a couple things. I'm like, next time we see her, she's going to be like fucking mech warrior. It's going to be.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be insane. It's going to be the Iron Giant version of Bobby. And I can't wait. I cannot wait.
Yep. That's exciting. So they, you know, are on this mission. They're trying to track down who's leaking the supplies. She thinks it's this admiral. Salvatore,
I think is how they pronounced it. And he was Alex's captain on a ship back when Alex was in the Navy and Alex was just a sled driver. So they had this connection that Alex is hoping to use to get a little bit of information.
Yeah. And he, during the course of this, he goes to the school where the military school, I think, where he's giving this speech about tactics, in this course. And then he connects with one of his underlings. I don't really know the position of this woman.
She's a lieutenant. Must be one of his assistants, you know.
Yeah, something like that. And she's trying to get information from him about why he's there. And he's trying to get information from her. It's kind of that classic, you know, two people with ulterior motives here.
Plus, Alex, the fucking idiot that he is more interested in the romance angle.
There's that, like, too.
Like,
yeah.
You know, Bobby, you know, I think she's into me, kind of like, and Bobby's just like long suffering, like, Alex, come on. And
I love it. Yeah, this is so Alex.
It is. It's very Alex.
Yeah. He's the guy who makes, he's unlucky in love. He makes a lot of romantic mistakes. And he's here confronting two of them now, making two of them.
Yep.
Yeah, and so they they figure out why he's there, because he's investigating the Admiral, and they try and kill him, but Bobby comes in and saves him at the last minute. So they've basically sussed out, okay, this Admiral is involved in this, but we kind of dead end there, I think.
I want to talk about some of the just like crowd pleasers. Alex suggesting to meet at this fucking...
this Mariner Valley bar. I fucking love it.
Yeah, deep south. Got saddles for seats. Probably got a mechanical bull in the corner. Uh-huh. Shit-kicking Martian bar.
These LED cowboy hats.
Oh, yes. The 5-gallon LED radioactive hats. And just it's Bobby so not having any of it. Like, yeah. Oh, my God. Can you live down the stair... And just giving some brutal truth, like everyone is ex. Are they still married?
Who?
Is him and Alex? Lydia his wife?
Maybe officially, maybe technically, but yeah.
They're like super estranged. But like the brutal thing of like, you know, well, which answer do you want? And the answer you're actually getting is you don't get to know. Fuck off.
Yeah.
His kid saying, like, I got to go, Dad. I got to hang out with my friends. And, yeah, I probably don't love you anymore. And then Bobby being like, yeah, you want to be your son's hero? You should have showed up 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the thing is, like, Bobby's pretty pissed because she's a Martian, and she's been disillusioned by what Mars has become and what Mars' future is going to obviously be. She's kind of probably still bristling over the fact that she's a traitor to mm-hmm. Mars. If she wasn't before, she is now. And, you know, this guy coming back and just wanting to be like old times is really deeply pisses her off. But she needs him. I like seeing Alex go through in high speed all the things that Bobby went through in a more controlled fashion last year. Like the war college lecture. It's too bad because that whoever stood up and asked the question, the Admiral looked like a real jerk ass, because I'm like, what? How can you not see that this is an important choke point?
Yeah.
Like, are you flunking out of military college? But it explains the people that maybe were shaky on or returning from the previous seasons. Like, you know, oh, yeah, this is why Medina Station's important. And
right. I mean, you think about only one of these gates is actually could actually put up any resistance. You know, everybody who's going through the gate is going out there with supplies to survive and set up a colony. They're not going out there with warships. As long as you control the one to Sol system, you're good.
Yeah. And how would you even, like, what would fighting within the ring station even look like? You know, the last time stuff like that happened, a lot of bad shit went down. So, like, you piss off the wrong machine in there and fusion stops working, or... you know, you can no longer bind oxygen to carbon, then you're fucked. And I think the thing that's scary about this guy, though, is like, if you listen to his speech, it's pretty fucking fashy, because he's essentially saying, like, you know, sometimes you can't think about stuff too hard. You just got to act, and you got to be ready for bold, you know, manifest destiny type situations. It's the kind of rhetoric you'd hear from a guy who's just going to amorally sell everything off for his own profit to, I don't know. Does he think, that's the other question is, like, is this guy, because Alex described him, he said he's got more dust in his veins than blood. Has he really turned this traitor to Mars? Is he really this about personal advancement? Or does he think in some kind of Magneto way that this is the best way? Does he think that, like, Mars and the belt can overcome Earth together? Like, I'm really curious to see if he's got any agenda beyond just, like, how can I get rich? How can I make a buck off of this?
I don't know. Like, I have to, if I'm him, and I've, you know, been this Martian loyalist for so long, and I see Mars crumbling out from underneath me, I have to, you know, fast forward a little bit and say, what is Mars going to look like in 10 years? If there is no Mars and the leadership of Mars is still intact, the government of Mars is still intact, what does that even mean? If there's nobody on Mars because everyone's left because it's easier to go out and find a new planet.
Yeah, it's going to look like Gary, Indiana. They have mayor and city council, too. But like, what the hell are they counseling?
He could sort of look at that as like Mars is not going to be Mars based anymore. Right. Mars is going to be based everywhere. Mars is the new humanity. And you know, whatever other leaders he can bring along with him in that goal, he'll do it. But like, Mars isn't a thing anymore. I think that's what everybody's kind of sussed out.
But it's scary because like putting the Martian mentality throughout all of humanity, I don't know, is necessarily healthy because like, you know, Martians are very collectively driven, which I think is cool and something that we should be more in 300 years in the future. But they're also very militaristic and they're also very organized around being deprived and doing without and always like looking over your shoulder and being in conflict with this other. That's not exactly a healthy mental attitudes to export. So like, taking the Martian mindset and remaking humanity into that. I don't know if it sounds like you need a synthesis of like the Terran, Martian and Belter philosophies to really have a healthy humanity. But
seems like it. Okay.
Oh, and also Alex. Alex getting jumped and like saving Bobby with his last vestiges of control, just spider monkeying this guy. Like, I thought that was really funny. And, you know, giving Bobby another chance to wreck shop was pretty cool. The open question I have going into the next episodes are, I feel like this lieutenant, Babbage, had Alex's number the entire time. And I'm not sure she gave him straight answers on this. This feels like a trap that him and Bobby are walking into.
She didn't seem prepared for the question. Like when he started digging about like which ship is it, you know, she didn't seem like she had a good answer. So she might have given him an accidental real answer.
Maybe. But I think she'll know. But that I'm just saying is like, and as cool as, you know, Bobby Draper as Iron Giant's going to be, there could easily be a dozen Marines with that much armor and more because they think they're going on an illegal arms sale. So you're gonna have a Martian skiff just packed to the gills with weapons.
Yeah.
So
could be
that could go badly.
One other thing that I liked seeing in this episode is the kind of external shots of all of these stations. Like you get one from Luna Station, and I don't know if that's the Armstrong facility or whatever that Officer Rollo was talking about.
Level City,
right. Okay, Armstrong must be somewhere else.
Named after almost doomed, but turned out heroic pilot or commander for Apollo 13.
Yeah.
By Tom Hanks.
That's super cool. I love seeing that. And I love seeing the Martian colonies here. Like you get a glimpse of like, the way that they transport from one place to another is via cable cars, which I thought was kind of smart for a low G rugged terrain environment, right?
Sure. Why overbuild it? You just got these like monofilament monorails slapping around everywhere.
And the amount of energy, it seems economical too. Like it can't take as much energy to pull these cable cars as it does to like, you know, hover in a spaceship and get that moving. Yeah. So like
there's hardly any air resistance on Mars too. Their atmosphere is very, very thin.
Yeah. No, it was really cool. I like seeing that stuff. And also,
you don't need Elon Musk vacuum tubes. You just essentially run them on the surface and get the same effect.
Absolutely. I also like seeing Baltimore. We get that with Amos, and maybe we can move over to Amos here and talk about that because he lands.
Let's do it.
In the level city on Luna, on the moon, obviously, and he gets pulled aside by Officer Rolla. And interrogated, like, why the hell are you here? Like, you're part of James Colden's crew. Something's up. He says, I'm here to, you know, investigate the death of this woman who meant a lot to me on Earth, and she lets him go, still suspicious. And then over the course of investigating that, he meets Lydia's lover, husband. I don't know what he is exactly, but they were together for many years, and she, like, leading up to her death, and Amos is trying to figure out, is this guy up to no good? Did something happened here, or did she actually die of natural causes? And he ultimately decides, okay, the guy's telling me the truth. And then this guy is living in her house, but he's being kicked out by the person who was paying for it, Eric, who will then see Amos go to and say, hey, you got to keep taking care of this Lydia's husband until he dies too. He's like, okay, fine.
Is this guy actually Amos's brother, or is that kind of like you know, the same way Belters call each other Baratna, you know?
As far as I know, it's a Baratna situation.
But they were, like, came up together because they talk about being street trash and like spending time on the docks and looking. So they have. And,
yeah.
And well, I understand that the real Amos Burton, which was, you know, we found out with through Monica's digging in season three, was a crime boss of note on Baltimore that disappeared. Mm-hmm. It sounds like Amos wanted to kill Eric. Our Amos, Timothy, decided to kill him instead and then put Eric in his position.
Or at least left a power vacuum enough that Eric crawled into it, right?
Yeah. And he's got this, like little, his like strong hand. So like, I'm not sure if that's a, I'm not sure what they're going with that. Like, is this like a mutation or,
just a birth,
an injury
birth defect
or a birth defect?
As far as I know, it's the same as in the book.
Okay, cool. But I thought that was pretty striking. And I like the fact that he loves this guy and they go way back, but he's also so dangerous. It's like, look, man, don't ever come back to the planet because I'll have to kill you. You know,
yeah.
Especially since Amos said, hey, I'm not here to take anything of yours except for this bomb ass bottle of bourbon. That's mine.
It's tequila. That's
it.
Actually.
That's it.
If I'm,
is it?
Yeah. If I'm to read into that based on the book, it's tequila. Amos loves tequila.
I want to also talk about, I like Amos flirting with Avasarala. They started this with teaching her to walk around, and yeah, he's calling her Chrissy now, and she's like, "Don't." And I'm a prime minister or whatever. I'm part of Parliament, not your favorite strippers. That you could be both. I love all that shit. I think it's really cute and funny. Him doing the reverse shakedown of the Belter shaking down the people in that shuttle. I was a little disappointed that they told the fight in almost all flashback.
I hated that moment. Like, look, there are moments that I don't like in this series. This is one of the very rare ones because, God, that amps me up. And this is, like I said, verbatim from the book. So I know what's coming here. And I'm like, I'm going to get to see this. Finally, it's described. I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, but I've told you, I know, in person. There is a one scene in book five. Where I lost my shit with Amos. It was amazing. It was written so well.
Was it this one?
It's this scene. Yeah. When he goes and fights these guys in the shower, the way they describe it in the book is like, he breaks that guy's arm, who comes at him with a gun or a knife or whatever. And then the guys start running at him. The book says Amos runs at them, arms outstretched, like greeting a long lost lover. And I just like, it's such a perfect description of the way Amos approaches hand to hand combat. Just, he's gonna, he revels in this stuff. He loves it.
He does. And there's so many, like the Easter egg I was talking about in the preview pod that we recorded last week. Did you notice it? That he's got his backpack is Mertry's backpack, and Mertry's name's crossed out in red, and Amos wrote in like, essentially crayon Amos over his name. So like, not only did he beat Mertry silly, he took all his shit and he's using his shit. And I thought that was really funny. Just the way that, the way he just kept interrupting this guy with this story about how long he could hold his breath with these, like, you could use knockout gas on me, but how many bones of yours do you think I could break? It's great.
And they also use that moment for some emotional. So here's why I didn't hate that. You know, showing the fight scene as flashback, because it gets you all amped up and you want to see him kick ass, but then they spin it into, instead of an exciting place, an emotionally devastating place, right? Where he's bleeding, he's standing under the water in the shower, just like zoned out. And you can tell
the wounded child.
This fight was not so much about like the injustice of this insurance scam or whatever. It's more about like what he's going to do to the person who perhaps killed Lydia, right, when he gets there. And it shows
bleed.
They do a great job with a character who is in a lot of ways a sociopath, in humanizing him and making him, you know, leak a little bit of emotion out of that facade throughout the course of these three episodes. I really like it.
And I like everything. Everything was so badass leading up to that. Just him just shutting these guys down and then him going to take a shower to his horrified roommates. Also, just like Amos willing this old lady to not snore anymore, just like staring her down as she's unconscious. Like, that was funny. And then he gets up. He's like, "What are you doing? You crazy?" He's like, I just hate waiting. This is gonna get this thing over with. Yep. The UN guys grabbing him as soon as he lands. He's like, "Hey, look, I didn't do anything." And also, are those guys started it and they were all alive when I left? I don't know. I feel like he killed at least one of those guys.
Say he didn't.
Did you? So here's a little detail I noticed that they talked about this Augustin Gamera Memorial. Now, I don't know if they made this a slight point in last season, because I remember Naomi talking about this, but I guess in the books, this was the ship that Naomi wrote this code to weaken a fusion reactor's containment field to stress test it, and shared it with him, and he used it to blow up a civilian ship. This is the ship. I don't think they've ever actually put that. Is this like an Easter egg for book readers or what? But like, I did a little, because I always like looking up the names of the ships. There's also this ship is named after a soldier and statesman by the name of Augustin Gamera. And he was like the Peruvian George Washington fighting for their independence. I thought, the fact that there's this memorial and this is kind of like, I don't even think Amos realizes it, but this is like a monument to Naomi's sins or her perceived sins.
Yeah, there's so many ships floating around. I don't remember this one.
Other really cool details about the Baltimore is I loved how all of the roofs are covered in solar panels, which, you know, we could do right now. Might be a good idea. I don't know. Advertisement for cricket protein.
Sure. There's a lot of like electric trains to go along with that.
And also, I was just kind of like, you know, the Baltimore doesn't look like, I've seen modern Baltimore and it doesn't look like, this doesn't look that shitty, but then it's just like, how many people are just everywhere living outdoors? People casually carrying around these enormous aluminum baseball bat with spikes and shit. Like, it looks like, you wouldn't be so bad to live there, but you see, you know, you scratch underneath the surface just a little bit and it's still a pretty dangerous town.
Yeah, I mean, they have the modern tech that's keeping everybody alive, but also it's still the projects, right? And you have to think, like, most of Earth is probably projects at this point. If you've got everybody on universal basic and you see what that looks like outside of the UN building, right?
Yeah, just like tons of homeless people milling around all the time. Like, I was wondering, like, how many of these people don't have a place to go? They're going to be like Charles, you know, just living in an alley someplace. And, you know, like Amos also just beating that drug dealer into friendship, I thought was, it's not funny, but it's Amos.
Sure.
And, and then the real question is, who the hell is he going to visit on Earth? That he needs Chrissy to help him with.
Mildly interesting.
Yeah. What is that? What is that?
Is mildly interesting. I can't say anything.
What is
about
that
it.
Hanging thread, and like, why? What's keeping him? And is he in any danger? Because like Eric told him, like, once you get it, and I kind of thought that maybe that was his ride that was leaving, and he just decided to overstay his visa or whatever. I wonder if this is going to put him in danger. Those were the questions I had at the end of the 3-episode arc with my good man Amos here.
Well, yeah, I mean, you got to think about all the people who are on Earth at this point, and it's Amos or all the people we know. Amos, Arjun is down there. He. You know, refused to go up to the moon last season with Avasarala when she left. I think that's everyone that we like really care about on Earth. There's clearly this one other person who I can't talk about yet, but this
is fam. I was thinking it's like some family we don't know about or some. Yeah. I also really like the flashback with Amos and Lydia because it shows, you know, we talk about, you know, Amos being a sociopath, which has always kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
It's not exactly accurate. He's shut down a lot of his emotions.
And you can, like, this kid was born into sexual slavery, then turned into mob muscle. Then he escaped Earth through violence and death. And it's like this interesting thing where her, like Lydia is saying, like, maybe we can fake it till we make it. And that maybe shows a path for Amos to rehabilitate. If he gets a crew that doesn't ask him to do a bunch of stuff all the time, that, like, you know, he can trust and that gives him unconditional love, like, maybe he could, you know, maybe there's a happy, because I've always thought that Amos was going to go out bloody in this series. That's like kind of his arc, that maybe sacrifice. But now I'm thinking, like, oh, maybe there is a future for Amos Burton other than violence and destruction.
I could definitely see that. I don't know exactly where they're going to go with all of that, but yeah. And they do a great job in that scene where he has a flashback with Lydia. Like I said, leaking that emotion out. He's sort of sitting in the same place where they were sitting and when she was giving him that speech, except it's nighttime and, you know, the gang of teenagers or whatever come up and start, you know, taunting him and stuff. And he turns around and he's just like, no. Mm-hmm. And they go, all right, not worth it. This guy clearly is a bad man.
Plus, Plus, he's armed now. He still has that gun. So, yeah, I was wondering if we were going to get another outbreak of Amos violence, but
yeah,
apparently not.
Yeah, I don't think he wants it in that moment. You know, he's come to do what he came to do. He found out that Lydia's death was not as sus as he might have expected. And then, yeah, I don't think he's a guy who's looking for violence. He's a guy who does not turn away from violence, though, when it finds him.
And it might be his first, it does seem like it is his first way to solve a problem, which is maybe not optimal.
Yeah.
And they also, there's the other thing that like kind of worried me about Amos, where like, cause you know, when a main character says to another main character, hey, if you do this thing, there's no way I can help you. And Amos is prone to do that one thing, which is killing somebody. I do wonder if he's going to be in some kind of legal jeopardy or what he's going to get in. What is he going to get himself embroiled in? Because it's almost like too easy. Like this plot, it's like I came here for a thing.
Yeah.
Turns out nothing needed to be done. Oh, I can take after this Charles guy. I'm going to go take care of this Charles guy. I took care of this Charles guy. I could get out and go on with my life, but there's this one other thing, and that one other thing usually, you know, in fiction is the thing that fucks you. So like, what is that going to be?
Yeah. Good questions. Let's talk about, I guess the final character here, Naomi. She goes off to mm-hmm. Palace Station to see her son, Philip. I can't remember exactly how this happens. How does she get wind that he is there?
So she has, Fred, as I guess she's put in a word since last season to Fred that, like, you know, kind of keep your ear to the ground, and he picks up something from an informant at Palace that has this, you know, Philip and his crew coming in and out of a ship, and that's what sets her off on it. Like, I got to get to Palace right away because who knows how long he'll be there, and that's what she does.
Gotcha. And you know, she has to have a conversation with Holden before she goes because they've never been apart since they met, right? I mean, you go all the way back to the whatever ice hauler they were on at the beginning of this series. And they, as far as I can tell, haven't left each other's side. So this is like a first where,
I mean, briefly on Illus where she had the gravity sickness.
And he went off to fight the alien tech. But not to like other sides of the system.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, where they couldn't talk on the radio. So I don't know. It's a nice moment between them. Like I think it's explained maybe slightly better in the books because this does happen pretty much exactly in the books too, where she describes, "Hey, you're just like I got to do a thing, and I don't want you to worry about me, but also it's." Not exactly sure what the outcome of this is going to be. I'll try to be back, just like everyone in the book says, I'll try to be back when they leave. I plan on coming back. And she just says, like, you got to trust me. I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing, but you got to trust me. I got to do this thing. Here, she just straight up tells him, like, my kid's out there. I need to go deal with this. It's a little bit different.
I thought it was interesting because she's on this freighter that I think she ends up purchasing called the Chet Smoka. And I looked up this was a Native American chief that was in Washington State and around Port Townsend today. And stop me if you've heard the story before, but they got screwed out of their land by a shady treaty.
And tell me, go on.
yeah. It's a story as old as time. Mm-hmm. And he went back to his people, and there's people debating whether they should just get up and kill every white person in what's now Port Townsend. And I guess over a period of time, he talked the tribe out of doing that. And he's like the celebrated figure in Washington. I guess there's a ferry that's named after him because he's essentially saved all the white folks. But...
Huh.
It's really interesting in conjunction with, you know, different attitudes we see in the show, because like, you know, we would if we were the Expanse version, we'd probably be rooting for that guy to, you know, like, well, you don't want them to be, you don't want a massacre and maybe you can have. But we also know how the history of Native Americans went.
Yeah.
So it really and this is all just like really, really background stuff. But I also think it's stuff that, like, you know, they intend us to kind of look into. And it really makes you think, like, what is the right action to do? You know, what is the right way to play things? Because if you do the things the quote unquote the right way and there's repayment, it's the extinction of your people. Then Jesus, was that the right way to go? It's interesting stuff.
And the show very economically captures all of this stuff that takes pages in the book of characters grappling with it, you know, internally and having conversations with other characters who are somewhat sympathetic to their cause, but have different approaches. It's really happening quickly and with, you know, not a ton of fanfare in the show. It's subtle, but it's going on. And when you pick up on those things, it just makes the whole universe richer for it.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know Phillips Gang, because I like these guys are very interesting characters. You got I'm going to call him the Big Bear and the antagonistic woman, because the Big Bear is like, he just loves Naomi. Clearly he's known her since she was a child and is kind of charmed by her. Whereas the one that's closer to Naomi's age is kind of like, yeah, you're the one that abandoned us. Mm-hmm. And we don't trend. You're working for an inner captain, an earther captain. And I thought that was an interesting prelude to how Philip was going to react to her. And if we're going to talk about that scene, I thought it was amazing, because it reminded me a lot of like Avasarala, where Avasarala was trying to fight Nancy Gao the way she knew how. And it completely backfired because it just betrayed her as this out of touch aristocrat.
Yeah.
You know, trying to get the vote of the people of Earth, which a vast majority of them are kind of in this stuck, terrible, like basic position. And how Naomi tried to appeal to her son, which is like, look, let me give you this ship. Let me give you all this money. And you can tell that Marco is probably like, you know, your mother abandoning us because she wanted the riches of the inner and she wanted to make herself better. And she thinks she's better than us. She wants to be an earther. Like, that just played into every bit of poison that Marco has poured into Philip's ear.
Yeah.
And it's tragic because she just wants to save him. But her approach was almost designed to confirm everything that his father told her about her. And I also was not seeing that him come back like and take her hostage. That's going to be like, she avoided getting taken hostage in the show last year, but now they're doing it to her this year. I'm very concerned, because that's the other thing about The Expanse, is it's been a few seasons since it's happened, but The Expanse will kill off a main character.
Oh yeah.
You know, episode 4, we thought we lost 1/5 of the Rocinante crew. Second season, we lost Miller. It's been a few, but like, I think The Expanse would kill Amos or Alex or Bobby or Naomi.
Might
not
have
all
to
of
kill
them,
Alex,
but,
you know, at this point.
Yeah. Well, right. So like, I don't really think that any of these characters are safe.
Because
that's not been The Expanse except for like the last season or so. So like that's one of the things that's kind of got me on pins and needles.
Yeah. So she's kidnapped at the end of this episode. We'll see where that goes. I can't say too much because this does happen in the books as well. But I think that's about it. We've covered all the characters. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we get out of here?
There's one thing I wanted to point out from an FX. This actually came up coincidentally over on The Mandalorian too. We talked last week on The Mandalorian show how they got this new thing called, it's called the Volume. It's this like 360 degree studio LED that they can project backgrounds, so they don't even have to green screen anymore. They can just throw, like, if you're on a desert planet, you're on a fucking desert planet. And if it's a background, it's good enough. I noticed that. I feel like The Expanse is doing a little bit of this, because that like wonder that you were talking about where they go through to Rocinante and all that and they board this pod that takes them all around the station. I'm pretty sure all that elevator was just big LED panels that was showing the station kind of zipping around to like really save costs. I noticed that a couple other places too. I think more and more, instead of like green screening and compositing, it's like now you've got these 4K, 8K displays. You just put them up there, make sure they're matte so they don't reflect, and it looks pretty good. It looks pretty fucking good, and I bet it's a whole hell of a lot cheaper than doing all that compositing stuff. So you keep thinking like, how are effects going to get better? And then you get like 6-degree freedom drones replacing crane shots, and you get these high screen LEDs serving as green screen replacements, and it keeps getting better and cheaper. And I thought it was cool to see The Expanse take use of some of that technology too.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to figuring out what they're going to do with the churn this year, that podcast, the semi-official like podcast that Ty and Dan are always on.
I heard it's Dan and Ty with Wes Chatham.
Really?
Wes is going to be essentially the host and just talking each episode over with them. Yeah. I just saw that on Twitter today, that's going to be how the episodes work. So that will be sounds like an entertaining as fuck show to listen to.
Yeah, no, I'm excited for that because they will talk about behind the scenes stuff like this. So maybe they'll talk about some of the effects at some point this season. That'd be really cool.
Yeah. So. But man, there is just all kinds of hell about to happen next episode. Because, at least one of the asteroids does hit. You know, it's not
and they talk about a 13-kilometer radius of destruction, right? And the megatonnage of the blast.
Not that, but like it hits in the ocean, so the tsunami is going to be pretty impressive, I imagine, too. So
yeah,
I wonder what kind of precision they had with those, like if it's just it hits any random place on Earth or... Because I thought that's like, well, maybe if like it hits in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, there's some places where that would not do a lot of damage with these size. Because these aren't huge asteroids. They're not like planet killers. They're, you know, city regional busters kind of thing in that range. 30 to 60 meters, they mentioned.
Yeah, and they
but 10 of them.
Right. There are a lot of them out there. And also, you know, they show kind of the devastation or at least a little bit of it. The initial impact. So what the fallout from those are going to be, right? Like, is this going to, how many people fallout. Are going to die? Like, will there be literal fallout? Like this, is this a extinction of the dinosaurs kind of event or what is this? Yeah. You know,
it probably wouldn't be sudden, but like, you know, if all 10 of those hit and they throw up a bunch of dust and they dim, like, you know, we talked about those power, the solar power, like if 50% of the Earth's sun doesn't get to the surface anymore, it's going to be devastating in terms of crops feeding people, in terms of energy.
I mean, you've seen the Matrix, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, and all the, you know, like also tsunamis are going to be really devastating when you look at New York City, which is like they always portray it as being like 20 meters underwater, these massive seawalls. So a 200 meter wave is going to do a hell of a lot of damage to the whole eastern seaboard. So I don't know. That's one of my questions. Like, how fucked up is Earth going to be after all this? So
yeah, we'll
see. Big stakes in the episodes to come.
I can't imagine that we have to wait long to get the aftermath of this because it's going to be important, right? Like that question is the number one question you have coming out of that third episode.
Right. And not for nothing, Amos is still on Earth.
Right.
If you don't care, Arjun is still on Earth. He's not Arjun, obviously. But you know, he's important to Avasaral and her family. So there's some real stakes. That's not just the however many billions of people walking around on Earth. We actually care about several of these people. So,
and don't forget like Nancy Gao, all of the heads of government are down on Earth and you know, who knows what could happen, if it hits in the wrong place on Earth.
It is interesting when you mention that like Chrissy's exile to Luna might not be a bad deal.
right.
You know, if one of these hits Washington or wherever, or New York City, wherever the UN UN is headquartered. I'm not sure if UN still in New York City.
You mean in the Expanse or you mean in our real life? In the Expanse, assume it's still in New York, but I'm not sure.
Because you could decapitate her, and I also don't know what the spacing of these asteroids are. They seem like they're pretty like in a line, so there's not going to be a lot of respite for poor Mother Terra here. But
well, that's the other thing you talked about. How accurate are these things gonna be on their trajectories? We saw they're not super accurate, right? Like they flung one so close to a star to the sun that it just broke up. Right? Yeah. So you know they didn't really like plan these trajectories perfectly. I doubt they're gonna be like, oh, you know what? We want to hit the UNN building, so let's set it on this course.
This stuff reminds me so much of the Tom Clancy I used to read, where it's like, you know, a terrorist puts a nuclear bomb in Denver, but the terrorist didn't know one technical thing. So instead of being like a 10 megaton bomb, it was only like a 10 kiloton. So it's like I said, like, you know, the Belters throw an asteroid and one of them breaks up. Like shit happens. Mistakes are made. You know, these aren't, you don't get a chance to test this. Like there's no trial run you can do. So, there's it might not be as bad as I think it might be, but also it could be a hell of a lot worse because the other thing is like, what if this is just his opening gambit? I don't know.
Yeah.
Marcos guys is scary.
We'll see.
What do you guys think, the listeners here? We are not going to be doing a lot of feedback these first couple of weeks because we're recording most of these before Christmas, in advance of Christmas, so we can take some Christmas time off. But we'll be back in the new year to consider all your feedback and catch up from that point going forward. Send that feedback in to expanse@baldmove.com. You can also discuss the episodes with our fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com. And can't wait to see episode 4. Can't wait to see all you guys back. Oh, also, don't forget, every Sunday, starting this one, we are going to be watching all of the new episodes of The Expanse on our Sci-Fi Sundays. It starts at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sunday night. You know what? Fuck work on Monday morning. Stay up a little late with us. Watch The Expanse. Watch some episodes of Star Trek. It's a good time. Twitch.tv/baldmove is where that happens. You can find our schedule, how you can participate. But it's a real good time. I'd love to see some of you guys and gals show up. That's it for this week. We'll see what happens to Earth next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.